This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is an Australian politician. He grew up in Western Australia and from his humble beginnings followed his dream to make an impact on the Australian government. He has worked alongside some of the biggest names in Australian politics, including John Howard, Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull. And you may have seen him a great deal on the news during the same-sex marriage debate, and he played a major role in what would be Australia's biggest day for the LGBTI people. This 49-year-old man is a member of the Liberal Party, and it was that very amendment to the Marriage Act which will forever have his name marked in the history of time. Not wanting to be defined by his sexuality, he always wanted to be defined by his actions. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Dean Smith to Word for Word.
I was the eldest of three, younger brother, younger sister. As a young man, I never believed I could serve as a senior advisor to a prime minister or a premier, because I was a gay man.
It took longer than expected, but Parliament fulfilled its promise to the people and finally made marriage equal.
And I never believed the day would come when my relationship would be judged by my country to be as meaningful and valued as any other. And then you come to that stage where you think, well, actually, yes, I am gay. So then what does it mean? What does it mean for my political beliefs?
Dean Smith has circulated a bill he believes the party can support.
It is now a time to heal, a time to build, a time to laugh, a time to embrace, a time to love, and now at last, a time for marriage equality.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Do people recognise you in the street?
Not many, but occasionally there are a few. I have a lovely story. I was on the street corner in Sydney a couple of weeks after the marriage debate, discussion, passage of the legislation. There were two lovely grandmothers came up to me and said, "Oh, Dean, how are you? And wasn't it fantastic on marriage?" And I thought, "Oh, isn't it lovely that these two grandmothers are so excited for their grandchildren?" Only to discover that they were a couple themselves that had been together for over 40 years.
Wow.
And it was such a powerful reminder of how resolution of the issue brought so much happiness to so many different people at different stages of their lives and different stages of their relationship. So occasionally I'm recognised, but not like Kylie Minogue would be or John Howard would be or like the Queen.
Well, I think it's kind of gorgeous, though, that these ladies stopped you and for that reason.
Well, two things. I thought, wow, isn't that great that they felt that they could approach me? So I think being a parliamentarian and being approachable to people is really important. Mm. And secondly, I loved how they said Dean. So there was this sort of, even though I didn't know them, there was a sense of familiarity. And I really liked that. I was really touched by that. Mm. I'm quite a shy person. I'm an introvert, which people find very hard to believe because politics requires you to be so extroverted. You know, the theatre of politics, the performance around politics is so important these days. But for me, I'm an introvert. Mm. But I do like it when people sort of reach out and say, "Yeah, you got that one right, Smith."
I think you're like Clark Kent because I think you're like a superhero who has achieved something quite amazing in a way, but you get to walk around.
In disguise.
Yeah.
Which suits my personality. I was one of those kids at primary school, you know, you might have known them. They were, writes letters to prime ministers and gets letters back. And I'd always wanted to be a politician or a parliamentarian ever since I was a primary school kid. So for me, this is the realization of what I've always wanted to do, but it is just my work. So making laws, passing laws, occasionally having to stand up and be a strong voice for people, that's just what I do. And on this occasion, I was grateful to have had the right sorts of qualities at the right sorts of time to bring to an end a very, very important issue, because the country was ready to bring the issue to an end in the way that it was concluded.
Oh, we're going to get into a lot of that, because you touched on a few things where I'm like, wow. But I want to go back to the beginning. You grew up in Western Australia, and you probably tackled the same obstacles that most young gay men would have had.
Mm.
What was it like to grow up in Mirrabooka? Am I saying that right?
No.
No.
You're not saying it right. Mirrabooka.
Mirrabooka.
Bingo. Which apparently in Aboriginal language means Southern Cross, or it means black boy. I've never really been able to discern what is the correct interpretation. But Mirrabooka is the name of the high school and the primary school that I attended in the suburb called Nollamara, which is a working class part of Perth. I spent my early years in Port Hedland, which is a town in the north of Western Australia. My dad was the local policeman, and I was the eldest of three, younger brother, younger sister. And, you know, looking back on it, I had a good childhood. Not an easy child, because things were tough for my parents in the 80s, etc. And I think as a parliamentarian today, I often think about how would people in Nollamara, or how would my parents be reacting to the sorts of things that they see politicians talking about. And my parents still live in their State Housing Commission house in Nollamara, 45 years later.
Like you said, your dad was a policeman and your mum stayed at home. I guess you're looking after the family, which is quite the typical Australian upbringing for your generation.
Oh, thank you. Without putting too fine a point on it, thank you very much. But exactly right. Exactly right. Yes.
What would you say your family life was like?
I was always surrounded by lots of cousins. So, cousins were always over for the school holidays. We were always going camping trips, camping as in pitch a tent trips.
Not the camp that I am. I get what you're doing there.
And so my childhood was always full of activity, and I'm grateful for my parents, because my parents came from more difficult family backgrounds. They obviously made a commitment to each other when they were married that they would give their kids the best lives that they could. Money was always a difficult issue because there was not a lot of it. Father, modest wage, being a policeman.
Would you say that there's a big difference between being a boy in Western Australia versus the rest of Australia?
When I look at younger guys these days, I do think that there's less of an opportunity for that sense of adventure or making your own fun, making your own play. But we had open bushland, bikes, swimming pools, and I think my father gave us quite a wide berth, if you like.
What sort of a boy was Dean Smith looking back?
I was a well-behaved eldest child. I think that was in large part because, I'm guessing now, because it's not really been talked about, my mother had a miscarriage between my brother, who's a few years younger than me, and my sister, who's 5 years younger than me. I think as a young boy, I sensed that, and that perhaps my mum wasn't coping, or that my mum had had an accident. And so I think, being totally frank, I think much of my behaviour as a young child, perhaps even through my adolescence, was trying to do everything to make things easier for my mum. So getting good grades at school, being well behaved. So in a way, perhaps my childhood was a bit repressed. Not because they were repressive, not at all, but because I was so eager to make their life free of conflict and trouble that I perhaps overcompensated by being a good kid at school.
What was the relationship like with your siblings, being that you had a younger brother and a younger sister?
Yeah, I was most definitely the responsible one. And they've taken very, very different sorts of career choices and life choices to me. My sister is happily married with two young children. My brother's not yet married. He's a policeman.
Like his dad.
Like dad. That's right. I did have, I've got all those oldest child traits. There's no doubt about that. When I did sort of start to sort of get out and about and, you know, live life, I think perhaps my parents weren't quite aware of how much living and life I was doing because I was quite a private person anyway. Yeah.
You're also quite close with your grandparents as well, growing up. Were they religious people, would you say, or no?
No, there is not a strong religious thread in my family. My mother jokes that she, before she met my father, she'd wanted to be a missionary overseas. I don't know how true. I'm probably the most religious in inverted commas. I mean, I'm privately devout, so I have a strong sense of what I would call my private faith, and I do lean on that very, very heavily. Where did I get that from? I do remember going to Sunday school as a kid. I do remember learning about the Good Samaritan. But it wasn't something that was sort of instilled in us with any sort of fervour, neither from my parents nor from my grandparents. So one of those strange things I picked up along the way.
It can happen, even without parents that are religious.
Yep.
You can pick up certain traits.
That's the critical point, I think. You know, having a spirituality that works for you. So the spirituality that works for me is sort of, you know, quite an orthodox view of Christ and his salvation, etc. But others will have different sorts of spiritual awareness that helps them guide or guides them through the complexity of everyday living. And I think for many LGBTIQ people, the complexities of life are more profound for us. So having a sense of something to guide you through that, to help you measure up competing sorts of tensions, is very important. And I'm always interested to know whether people do have a bit of a spiritual sense of things, and if so, how it works for them, how they came across it, when did they realize it, that this was important to them. And particularly as we get older, trying to find a purpose and meaning in all of this is important.
For me personally, I'm not religious myself, but I've certainly researched religion quite a lot, but just more for the curiosity.
The curiosity to understand what might be guiding other people's decisions or helping, or what framework they use to understand. I remember clearly just before my sister was getting married, I was living in London. This is before emails. So she rang me one evening and she hadn't been christened. And it was necessary for her to get christened in order to marry her husband, was a Macedonian Orthodox. And she just asked me, she said, "Oh, Dean, you know, if there's so much suffering in the world, you know, how can there be a God?" And I said, "Well, Rachel, I actually find it easier to understand suffering in the world by believing that there is a God, not by believing that there isn't." And I thought that was really interesting.
If people ask you if you're religious today, what do you say you are?
I say I'm privately devout. Meaning that I have a very, very strong private sense of my spirituality and I practice that privately. So do I go to church? No. Now, of course, I might get a rude shock one day at the pearly gates.
When you get to be faced against whether there is a God, I guess.
Agreed, yeah.
What age would you say then did you work out your sexuality? Like, what age did that start to come?
I was not one of those people that always knew. Not at all. And I think this is what caused some confusion for my parents and my friends. I was always one of these people that was surrounded by, you know, guys and girls and go out with girls and had sort of affections for girls. And then I hit a very, very difficult period when I was about 22. Very difficult period, very unhappy, which didn't make sense. I'd finished university. I'd been successful at university. I had a good job. But this real deep sense of loneliness and confusion just fell over me, and then I wrestled with that, couldn't understand what was going on. And then it is as simple as this. I heard that Rod Stewart song about I think it's called Georgie Boy, I forget the exact title of it, in my car driving to work, and then it dawned on me. I could see I was sort of being drawn to sort of, you know, male attraction. And when I look back on things, you know, the Mark Holden vinyl album where he's sort of lying torso naked on an eye in bed might have been an early sign if people had been paying more attention.
What would you say is your relationship between your religion then and your sexuality?
Well, this is I think this is a really very, very important question, because the coming out process is lots of processes. And that journey that we each have to travel when we know in ourselves we are gay, there is still that personal journey we need to travel before we feel we can share it with others. And that internal journey, if you like, that stage one, I think is still as difficult today as it has ever been. You know, that real personal journey where you think your family's going to disown you, you're going to lose your friends. So that's very important. And then you come to that stage where you think, well, actually, yes, I am gay. So then what does it mean? What does it mean for my political beliefs? What does it mean for my career choices? What does it mean for my religious views? And it was in, for me, coming out, I thought about that. I mean, why would this happen to me? Remember, this is in the 90s. This is a while ago now. But I had to think, I chose to think carefully. But I decided that I believed in a loving God and not a God of fear, that God was not trying to punish me, that perhaps the lesson I was being asked to learn and to understand was one of self-awareness, self-acceptance, you know, that if we do believe we are born in the image of God, then diversity is actually an expression of godliness. If we were all born the same, what is the lesson in that?
Well, it'd be boring for starters.
It'd be boring for starters, but there's no lesson about compassion. There's no lesson about love thy neighbour. There's no. So for me, I was able to reconcile quite quickly and very, very comfortably that I believed in a loving God, not a God of fear, that diversity was actually something that we were being asked to learn and to understand and to ultimately embrace. And people can say whatever they like about, you know, religion and religious freedom. All I know is that this is an understanding that is true to me.
What impact do you think that your sexuality then had on your transition from being like a child to an adult? Do you think that your sexuality threw you off course in any way?
It took me a long time to get comfortable in my own skin as a gay man. That for a long time there was Dean Smith the gay man, and then there was Dean Smith. And it has taken me a while for those things to be one. Mm. And now that they are one, life is much easier, life is much happier, because you can't live those split lives. So the sooner you get to reconcile those, the better it is. And that's why I think acceptance is so critical. Splitting your lives like that in the 90s and the early 2000s was a survival mechanism as well. Mm. I mean, it was not as accepted as common as it is now. And so you have to live in the world that you're living in. I mean, so yeah, there were two different. There was the Dean Smith, the gay man who kept it very, very private. Sure, I'd go to gay clubs with my mates and that sort of thing. But would I talk about being gay at work? No. Would I talk about having gone to gay clubs at work? No. Would I have talked about, you know, the cute guy I saw in the shops, you know, once? No, I wouldn't do that. Whereas now,
you feel comfortable to say that.
Absolutely. I am one person, Dean Smith, who happens to be gay and happens to be all these other things as well.
Which begs the question, what age did you feel comfortable to talk about your sexuality with your parents? Mm.
Well, I came out to them one evening after our, you know, regular family dinner, and I hadn't planned to, but events just transpired. Then I went to London and lived for 3 years. Interestingly, it didn't actually get talked about in our family for a long time. But again, sex and sexuality was never talked about much in the family at all. So on one level, it just meant broad acceptance and it wasn't a problem. On another level, and perhaps more honestly, it was that we didn't really know how to approach the subject.
So you just swept it under the carpet?
I just didn't. So if I was dating someone, I didn't talk about it, didn't share it.
You didn't get to bring them home.
Well, I did take one guy home once at one Christmas, and a couple of months, this was many, 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 many years later, and a couple of months later, things hadn't quite worked out, and my mother says to me, oh, well, actually, yeah, I could see it was a bit too pushy for you, she said.
That person
that was, and we didn't think that was quite right.
Yeah.
You know?
We didn't care that it was a gay relationship, but they cared about the protection of you. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. The core issue that is, I think, as true today as it was when I came out a long, long time ago and will be true in the future, is that parents don't want to see their children lonely. So they want their children to find love and to find a special person in their life. For many years, being gay was equated to being lonely and alone in life, particularly in older years. That's not the image now, and that's why I think marriage has become so important, because it says that finding life partners is possible, having that social contract publicly shared and endorsed with people, I think gives lots of people an opportunity to sort of not feel like their children are going to be alone and lonely in the world. And that was my parents' fear. My parents' fear was that, oh, you know, what happens when we all go away? You know, you'll be left here by yourself, meaning when they pass away. And of course, I think that is a fear that everyone has, whether they're gay, straight, or whatever.
Mm. Your stories wake people up, and you have such a huge following now. It's interesting when you look back, what would you say to Dean Smith if he walked in at the age of 12, if you got the opportunity to have that conversation with the younger Dean?
The message for the young Dean is that it'll be okay. Mm. It will all be okay. Over the 6 years that I've been a senator, I think the one thing that I've really wanted to be able to do is to say to young Australians, no matter where you're from, no matter who you are, no matter how you identify, you can do and be whatever you want to do and be in this country. An astronaut, a politician, tennis player, doesn't matter. But in this country, you can be what you want to be.
It's documented that you joined the Liberal Party when you were 17, but what age did you know that you wanted to be a politician?
It always been with me as a kid. You know, my mother says I watched a lot of current affairs programs as a kid on the black and white television. I'd always wanted to do it, but I think the issue was, how would I do it being a gay man? Because even up until, you know, perhaps a few months before I won my Liberal Party pre-selection, people would say, oh, you've worked so hard, you'd be a good politician, but there's no way a gay man's going to be a senator from the Liberal Party. Because, of course, up until that point, no openly gay man had been a member of the Federal Parliamentary Liberal Party. Now, I'm sure there have been gay men, but
you were the first openly gay one.
Open is important. I'm not going to allow it to be a weapon against me. I own who I am. I am an openly gay man. And saying to people very early that honesty and authenticity and integrity were key characteristics that I wanted to take into my political career, I felt it was important to say that. Others had different views. Others said, oh, no, you don't need to talk about it, Dean. Everyone knows that you're gay. Well, in a way, that's an attempt to keep gay people invisible. That people say, oh, you don't need to mention it because we all know. Well, actually, no, I do need to mention it because it's an important element of who I am. It's not the element, but it's an important element in the same way my hair colour or my religious views. And this is the lesson I've learnt in the last couple of years. We've got to be very, very alert to unconscious and conscious behaviour that seeks to make LGBTI people invisible.
I think it's a very important thing to highlight, because sometimes you don't feel comfortable in saying that you're gay to people in the workplace or having ownership over it. But the moment that you are proud of who you are and comfortable to share who you are, there's this thing that you get. Mm. It's like magic. And for people out there that don't tell their work they're gay or don't seek pride in who they are, it holds them back immensely.
Well, this is a really important point, because people might misinterpret why you are concealing your sexuality. People might say, I don't need to mention it because I don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable. That's fine. Or I don't need to mention it because it doesn't actually affect the work I do. That's fine. But by not mentioning it, you could be unconsciously saying to people, I'm ashamed of it, or I'm embarrassed by it. And that would be a great disappointment, because that self-acceptance has to have at its core an acceptance of your right and the respect that is owed to you, because you are a living human being, first and foremost, and second to that, a living human being who is gay, in our case. These things are very important. And that's why pride is the opposite to shame. And it's important that we do act with proudness and we do demonstrate pride, because that is a way that we combat and challenge and hopefully erase over time the shame that is often felt by being LGBTIQ.
That inner shame.
Yep. Yep.
You know? Where would you say your passion came from to be a politician?
I think, well, I know this, that I often say to people that my interest in politics is an extension of my parents' civic-mindedness. So what I mean by that is that my parents are not interested in politics and are still not interested in politics. Sure, they go and vote, etc. But my father was, even though he was a policeman and a shift worker, my father ran the football club, ran the swimming club, him and my mum ran the PNC. So I saw, even though I was embarrassed about it as a kid, I saw my parents constantly involved in community groups, keeping those community groups going so that other kids in other families could learn to swim, participate in swimming carnivals, go on Boy Scout camps. So I think I could see the difference they were making in our own little community in terms of keeping the thread of that community together. So I think for me, I could see that by being involved in things did make a difference.
Mm.
And so on top of that, my mother tells this story about how for many, many years she voted for the local Labor parliamentarian, state parliamentarian, because he put a footpath on our street, which meant that she could take me and my brother to the local park safely. We didn't have to walk down the road. And so she voted for that local member of parliament for many, many years. And for me, that was a really powerful demonstration of how all politics is local. So for me, the passion is this really strong belief that you can actually make things happen. You can make good things happen, or on occasion, you can stop bad things from happening. So I'm absolutely one of those people that believes that by being a parliamentarian, you can make things happen.
Why are you a Liberal member, not a Labor member?
I think, remember, my father came back from Vietnam. So his view would be, and it's a view that I support, that he was treated poorly by the Whitlam government and by the left of Australian politics who were arguing against the Vietnam War. I think it's fair to say my father is a Liberal voter. I also grew up in the 1980s. That's when I came to my sort of political consciousness. And in Western Australia, we had the Brian Burke era and we had the WA Royal Commission. These things happened afterwards. But what I quickly discerned was that when I looked at my parents and the struggles that they were having raising children as a young couple, etc., I then looked around and saw state Labor and federal Labor governments and couldn't understand why life wasn't easier for my working parents. So I, early on, perhaps distrusted the Labor message. I went to university, studied politics, and they became much, much drawn to this sort of classical Liberal view that government should be smaller because people can make their own decisions about the lives that they want to lead. I think that taxes should be lower because the more that people have in their own pocket to make decisions for them and their families, that is a better decision than having to pay higher taxes to support things that may or may not be in their interests.
Have you ever felt at times in your career that you've questioned your Liberal beliefs?
Oh, there have been times over the 30 plus years that I've been a member of the Liberal Party that decisions of the Liberal Party have disappointed me, where the Liberal Party has disappointed me, but Liberal values haven't disappointed me. The more I do this job, the more I look around me, the more I see the durability and importance of Liberal values. Of course, the party on occasion will disappoint you or not live up to your expectations of it.
Sometimes Liberal supporters come across like Collingwood supporters. And there's a sense of arrogancy that comes with both of those things, which brings me to my point. There is nothing arrogant about you, my friend. And that makes me think that there's a big distance between you and the Liberal beliefs.
I spend a lot of my time in and around communities trying to give, challenging people because saying, oh, well, he's a Liberal senator. We wouldn't have thought a Liberal senator would come to our remote community. We wouldn't have thought that a Liberal senator would be interested in Indigenous issues. We wouldn't have thought that a Liberal senator would find time to come to an LGBTI community group meeting. So I'm just trying to wave the flag for a community-driven view of what liberalism means and trying to demonstrate to people that liberals are interested in their communities, that the footpath is a worthy issue to be working on, and that you might, in the process of helping one family, get their electoral support for years to come.
I think all of these attributes are the attributes of a senator.
Mm.
A good senator.
Well, a good parliamentarian.
What makes a good politician?
I think a bit of self-awareness. Feet firmly planted on the ground. A sense that it could be over as quickly as it begun. That it is about getting achievements done for people, and it's not about politics.
For young LGBTI people that are out there wanting to get into politics, what advice do you have for them?
Get in early. What I know about the Liberal Party is that Liberals like to select people that they know.
Mm.
So when I was selected, I wasn't selected because I was a gay man. I was selected because people had seen me work hard for a very, very long period of time. They knew who I was. They could pretty much guess what my reaction would be to certain issues. And that's because I had gone to branch meetings, gone to events, participated in campaigns. So for some people, they're lucky enough to roll up on the first day, get the endorsement, and then, you know, go on to bigger and greater things. But for the bulk of us, we have to work at it. It's important to make a decision, join early, and parties are there to be led and to be changed as well. If you don't have to accept a party for the way that it is today. You can actually change political parties.
You were the senior advisor, though, to Prime Minister John Howard.
During the 98 election campaign, that's exactly right, yeah.
And he got re-elected.
Mm.
So what did you learn from that experience?
Well, I am a fan of Howard, and for this reason, and I think this is the lesson that political people today need to learn and apply, that John Howard, in opposition and in government, was totally consistent. People knew what his views were. And so even if they disagreed with him on a particular view or particular issue, they knew that he was considered, they knew his views were consistently held, and they rewarded him for that. So they were prepared to excuse his position on certain issues, but because they knew that he was consistent in his views and consistent in his principles, that's what made him a strong and confident leader, and Australians rewarded that. So the consistency of positions and the consistency of applying principles are what I think Australian electors are looking for today. So if Malcolm Turnbull wanted to be more successful, he could apply those principles that people think he holds more consistently.
During that experience, though, I have to ask, you were working with John Howard. I don't know how out you were at this time, but did you ever talk to John Howard about your sexuality?
No. He's the Prime Minister of the country, and there are more important things for him to be doing, and to be honest, more important things for me to be doing, working on an election campaign to get the Liberal coalition elected.
But what happens if something comes up? Something comes up like changing the Marriage Act that directly affects you, and you're working with John Howard. Did you not feel like you wanted to say to him, I'm a gay man, and I think that there are some things wrong with changing the Marriage Act?
The short and real answer to your question is no. But have I spoken to John Howard about the issue of same-sex marriage since the passage of the legislation? The answer is yes, briefly, when I met with him to talk about a range of other issues a few months ago.
How did that conversation with John Howard go?
It was sort of just on the periphery. It was just in passing.
But what had it go?
Well, it was polite. It was not an in-depth conversation. It was polite.
It's interesting to me how he changed the Marriage Act and you were the one who changed it back.
John Howard and I are hugely united in our opposition to an Australian republic, but of course we'll have different views about some issues. That's healthy.
Did he say sorry?
No, and I didn't ask him to.
He didn't ask for an apology.
I think the most important thing in all of this, though, is how great it is that the country stepped up.
The only thing that I would say as I move away from it, but does that create a duality for you? Like, as in, without talking comfortably about your sexuality to John Howard or to your political party or to the people that you work with, was that pushing you into a duality?
It forced a constant conversation in my head about how do you be more authentic?
Mm.
I was very, very clear that if I ever went into Parliament, people would be very, very clear that I was an openly gay man, that people would be clear that if they were asked to pre-select me, they would be clear that I was an openly gay man. And for me, people have always known that, and whether they liked me or not liked me, whether they voted for me or not voted for me, that has always been part of their consideration. So when I first ran for Parliament in 2007 in a House of Representatives seat, I lost. Now, I lost for a whole variety of reasons. I wasn't the local candidate. Some people would say I was probably a little bit too young, but everyone knew I was a gay man. What was interesting is that no one could ask me the question, are you a gay man or what does that mean? But I did get a question from the back of the room about, you talk about family values, but how can you talk about family values if you don't have a family of your own?
What was your answer?
My answer was that, of course, I come from a family, but family values are not about structure. They're about values like trust and honesty and unconditional love.
Mm. Luck, chance and circumstance, but also at the same time, do you think determination that you have is what saw you grow?
Tenacity is important, yes. And when everyone else starts to give up, that's when you need to swim harder. And there's a great analogy here that I was sharing with some people in Western Australia a few weeks ago. So my father was the swimming coach in our swimming club. And everyone will be familiar that in a swimming pool, there's a black line. And at the end of the black line is a T bar. And often what happens in swimming races is that when people see the T, they think, aha, the wall is almost there, the race is almost over, and they slow down. When in actual fact, and you see this in the Olympics most vividly, when in actual fact, when you see the T bar, that's when you need to go the hardest. And that's where you often win the race, at the very, very end. So when everyone else is starting to slow down or give up, that's when you've actually got to go the hardest.
Dot the I's and swim faster at the T's.
And hit the wall hard.
Did you at this stage start to think that who you are personally was going to benefit from the hard work you'd made?
I did not and could not have foreseen the events of 2017 when I entered the Senate in 2012.
You didn't support marriage equality.
Agreed, exactly. And it's important to be honest about this, that in 2012 when I went to the Senate, I did not believe in same-sex marriage. I gave a speech speaking against same-sex marriage in September 2012, and I voted against same-sex marriage when the private members bill was put before the parliament.
Can you summarise exactly your point of view at that time?
Yep, I can. Put simply, I didn't think that the issue had community support. I think that's true. It didn't in 2012. For me, being a conservatively minded person, small c conservatively minded person, it was a campaign being run by the left. A campaign that was owned by the left, the far left of Australian politics. It wasn't owned by contemporary Australian politics. Thirdly, I just couldn't see, and it might have just been the circles that I moved in, I just did not see a lot of gay people thinking that this issue was important. But then over time, for a whole variety of reasons, it dawned on me the principle of equality before the law is actually a really important and critical principle. And I'm happy to talk about equality before the law in all these other areas. Why wasn't I happy to talk about equality before the law in regards to same-sex relationships, regards to marriage law?
Why?
Good point. Perhaps I just hadn't focused enough on it because I was preoccupied trying to get myself to Parliament. And these were not issues that Liberals were talking about.
It's a brave man to admit that.
You know, that's honest. You know, I do remember very, very clearly when that vote happened in September 2012, the reaction and the excitement and the joy of some of my Liberal Party colleagues when that bill had been defeated. Now, remember, I voted against it, but I couldn't quite... I left the chamber a little bit sort of confused. How could you... Even if you didn't believe in same-sex marriage, how could you be excited? How could you be joyous about the fact that you had denied a group of people equality before the law?
A basic human right.
And that might have been the starting point for my evolution.
You talked about politics being left and right. Would you say that the Liberals are heading more left or more right?
More right. Is that right? No. I think they are moving more right, not because the Australian community is moving more right, but because the Liberal Party membership is narrowing and becoming more capital C conservative. The modern challenge for the Liberal Party is to make sure that it remains a contemporary, modern, centre-right political party that is reflective of centre-right community views.
Who have you enjoyed collaborating with the most?
The greatest collaboration that I've been involved in was with Anna Brown, Lee Carney and Corey Earlham in preparing the marriage bill. And why was that collaboration good? Huge amount of trust. Huge amount of trust. That was... and, of course, there was success at the end of that. But tremendous amount of trust. I suppose this is what I get embarrassed about, is that people say, the Smith bill and, the McKinnon political prize. Well, actually, you know what? I was just part of a quattro. And that quattro was Anna Brown, Lee Carney and Corey Earlham. And you know what? I could not have done it without them. Now, they might say we couldn't have done it without, Dean. But that, I think, just demonstrates how tight and how close we became. And it was all about trust. Mm. It was high stakes. Perhaps I've underestimated that over the last 6 or 7 months.
What do you feel these days with sometimes the negative press that comes out for some politicians? So if you look at some of the things with Tony Abbott, do you sometimes see that there's a different person, or have you had the luxury to see that there's a different person behind the public's perception?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think a very obvious case for me is Bronwyn Bishop. So I worked closely with Bronwyn in early 2000, and I saw a lady that worked hard, who had great compassion. You wouldn't think that if you just relied on the press stories. Bronwyn Bishop was the Minister for Aged Care. I travelled with Bronwyn to Tasmania once.
By helicopter?
No, by plane. Call us old-fashioned. But we went to an aged care home that was dementia-specific, and I saw great care, great compassion. That's the privilege some people get of working with high-profile parliamentarians, that you do get to see people's public and private character.
Is it inappropriate to play this game with you really quickly, but to say murder, marry or kiss these three people? John Howard, Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull?
I really can't. I feel like such a party pooper.
Let's change it up a little bit. And instead, let's say if you had to collaborate with those people on a short basis or for an ongoing relationship or never again, would you classify those three people?
I'd be happy to work with Abbott on a short-term policy.
Mm-hmm.
I would be having the opportunity to draw on John Howard's sort of extensive knowledge about community attitude. So I would like to be able to sort of draw on him and trust him for a long-term project. And Malcolm, well, I just stand ready to do whatever I have to do as a member of the backbench.
Well, I'm going to take that as an answer to the first question. That's a bit inappropriate. you were described as the unsung hero by Christine Forster, and she believes that you were the reason we got marriage equality across the line. Can you explain what you included in the bill to make sure that it happened?
Oh, absolutely. That's a much easier question than the previous one. Well, what this bill had that none of the other bills had was a responsibly crafted provision for religious freedom. Now, none of the previous bills had had that, not in the way that this bill had it. And importantly, that those religious freedom protections were drawn out of a Senate Select Committee process that had happened in January 2017. So during the Senate Select Committee process, the churches, the LGBTI community, lots of people with an interest, presented their views to the Senate Committee. The Senate Committee then prepared a unanimous report, and it was that report that guided the crafting of the religious protections in regards to marriage in that bill. That was the that is what made the bill broadly acceptable, remembering that the Greens would have preferred not to have had some elements of those religious protections, remembering that even in Labor, views can be quite divided in terms of whether or not the bill needed that. Then, of course, for some Liberals, they would have liked, and Nationals, they would have liked to see more generous religious protections. So it was the fact that here was responsibly crafted bill that the bulk of people could sign up to, that meant everyone actually having to give up a bit. Because it was not, as Richard Di Natale said in the Parliament, it's not the bill that they would have wanted. But it is the bill that the community could all agree on and the Parliament could all agree on. So it was and it wasn't really cleverness, because the amendments were designed with a product of listening carefully to what people were saying.
There was a point where people wondered if religious protection and same-sex marriage could coexist, and how could they both be protected. Where did those people's concerns come from?
I think that for some people, they'd been involved in the debate for a very, very long time. And what that meant was that their positions had hardened, and hardened because some people have fought. So some people have fought this fight much, much longer than others. Many people have fought it much longer than I was fighting it. And so they come with a lot of history and a lot of association with the issues. And sometimes that means it's a little bit harder to give up some territory. But what was critical about the success here was that it was the community's bill. It's the Parliament's bill. It's not. It might have had Smith's name on it, but it was owned by the community. It's owned by the Parliament. It's owned by the people who responded yes to the postal survey. So rather than being the product of one person, it is actually the product of lots and lots of people over a very, very long period of time.
It proved that you were considering a lot of people and the majority.
And that people were prepared to give up a bit of their own territory on the issue in order to sign up to something that lots of other people could sign up to as well.
I had this weird theory, though, with the debate of freedom of speech and concerns of religious protection. You know, was all of this political jargon to just muddy the waters and sort of shut down or slow marriage equality?
I think that for some no campaigners, there was a deliberate effort to slow the caravan down.
I felt like as they were debating it just seemed to me that they were using some political jargon to confuse people and to frighten people into supporting something.
For some people, the objective was never to have same-sex marriage in our country. So slowing it down, putting hurdles in the way was absolutely their objective. Then there were others who said, yep, I'm comfortable with same-sex marriage, but I want it heavily burdened with all of these, I would argue, unnecessary religious protections. Unnecessary because the evidence was not there to say they were necessary. And then there were others who, like myself, were supporting same-sex marriage but did want to see responsible religious freedoms. And there are other people who wanted to see same-sex marriage with no religious freedoms. But the point being that we were able to get to a position where Parliament overwhelmingly could support an unamended bill. An unamended bill.
Because I guess people were always going to try and crawl it back or try and debate things.
And that's part of the parliamentary process as well. Everyone's got a right to bring forward their own amendments. I was surprised just how spectacularly unsuccessful the amendments were.
Those concerns that people had, God, what's going to happen to Australia if marriage equality happens? There certainly wasn't the fallout that people thought could happen.
No, that's right, exactly. I mean, I call it same, same, but different. Life is the same for all of those people who are unaffected by marriage. But life is very, very different for those people who now do have the opportunity to marry. Very, very different for those people in the LGBTI community who saw in the marriage bill a really powerful sign of acceptance. and all of the things that were said have not yet been realised, and I actually don't think they will be realised.
Is it telling that the statistics of people getting married, being as low as they are, just a representation of the fact that Australia was fighting for equality and less to do with marriage itself?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely agree with that, that the issue of marriage became a very, very powerful demonstration about how LGBTI community in Australia were not being treated equally before the law. So marriage became a very, very powerful symbol of that. And so I think actually the success is not how many people have actually taken up the opportunity to be married, but the success is that level of acceptance that not just LGBTIQ, but also their friends and family feel, and the comfort that people feel moving in and around their communities. I mean, I overheard someone said that she felt much more comfortable walking down the street holding her partner's hand. Well, actually, that's not about marriage, but that it is about acceptance. And I think that's just as worthy a goal.
You were very vocal about the fact that you were against the plebiscite, as was I. And the reason for it was that I was working in central Queensland at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm sometimes an emotional person. And I directly had relationships with people who lost their life whilst the plebiscite was on. And do you feel angry at all that they continued with that plebiscite? Are you annoyed that that's how it came across? Or in hindsight now, do we look at it differently?
Oh, no. Hugely disappointed that the postal survey was allowed to happen. Hugely disappointed still that people think, oh, well, because it got the right result, it must mean it was necessary and a suitable mechanism. No, absolutely not. Because the postal survey could have easily delivered 49-51 outcome. What would that have done to our country? What would that have done to families and suburbs? So the postal survey could have delivered a very, very different outcome. And when people say, oh, it was always going to deliver that strong result, you don't know that. No one knows that. It could have been, had the No campaign been run very, very differently, could have been a very different outcome. Had the Yes campaign been run very, very differently, it could have been a very, very dangerous outcome. Imagine having a postal survey in our country, 49-51 is the outcome. What are the politicians going to do then? See, I oppose the postal survey because parliamentarians are elected to go to parliament and make decisions. And every 3 or 4 years, depending on where you are, you get to say, yes, my parliamentarian's done a good job or my parliamentarian's done a bad job. Very, very hard to hold the community accountable for its decision in a postal survey. I just think it's absolutely outrageous precedent. I will fight the next postal survey, I'll fight the next plebiscite, because Parliament is elected to do these sorts of things in our country.
Why did Malcolm Turnbull deflect?
It was a political management tool. He obviously didn't think that he had the necessary political capital to lead the party and lead the Parliament on this issue. Some people say that they felt bound by the fact that we went into the election in 2016 saying that we would give people a say. A bad idea is a bad idea, whether it's an election commitment or not. Yep.
Do you think that they still think it's a myth that people out there lost their lives? Because I believe that they went quickly to celebrate. They believed that it needed to happen, and they completely sidestepped the issue that the LGBTI community was devastatingly hurt during that plebiscite.
I believe that many in the government had no comprehension and still have no comprehension of the significant hurt and damage the postal survey did to LGBTI people and their friends and family. Absolutely. The government's decision to make about $8 million available to LGBTI mental health services in January of this year is a late recognition that they knew the postal survey was damaging.
Why wasn't that made more of a big deal of?
I think it probably wasn't made more of a big deal of because it would sort of invite a commentary, invite a discussion around the postal survey again and the merits of the postal survey. And I think people just are happy for the issue to be all about 2017 and not drift too much into this year.
Is there something that you look back at that you feel particularly proud of?
Because as a parliamentarian, as a senator, you represent lots of different people and lots of different issues. It's hard to... Having had the trust of my colleagues to lead that parliamentary element of the broader campaign for marriage is something I feel proud about. The trust that people were happy to put in me to do that, it's taken me a long time, but I do feel really honoured by, really feel privileged about. And so I'm particularly proud of that. But what I do like, and thanks very, very much, is that a lot of people say, oh, that'll be the best thing you ever do in your parliamentary career, full stop. You said thus far, because I do enjoy being a parliamentarian. I want to continue to be a parliamentarian. I'll do it for as long as I've got the support of West Australians and Liberals in Western Australia. But I'm not going to be idle. I'm not going to sit comfortably and watch the world go by. If you're a parliamentarian or anyone in a position of responsibility, you've got opportunities to make a difference. And I think what I've seen in my own brief period as a senator is what I saw in my parents, that you can make a difference. You can change things. You can change things on a big scale, like marriage, or you can change things on a small scale, like trying to make life a little bit easier for grandparents who are caring for grandkids.
You're at the tea.
I'm about to hit that wall really quickly.
Well, you're going to bounce and keep going. Like, you know, that's what I think.
It's called a tumble turn.
The tumble turn, tumble turn. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
King out. Have you got a message to the queer community that might have been listening to this right now?
I do. It will all be okay. It's always more powerful to speak in optimistic language.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.